Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Okay, hello.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Hello, everybody.
Hope everyone is well, and I apologize again for the warm air today. As George mentioned, this is one of our last programs here in this temporary space, and we're all very excited about moving very shortly. Of course, I'm Gloria Duffy, the president and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and welcome to today's program here at the club. As you know, probably, you can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet, commonwealthclub.org, see our videos on YouTube or Facebook, catch up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and all of those good social media sites. This program today is part of the club's Good Lit series, which is underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. So, San Francisco, as many of you know, has a strong Buddhist presence. There's traditional practice here by those from Japan, China, Tibet, and other countries, and there are also many Western practitioners. And San Francisco has also been somewhat of a center of advocacy for human rights and independence in Tibet. And some of our political leaders, we spoke earlier of Richard Blum, Dianne Feinstein's husband, who's been active in this realm, and also Nancy Pelosi over the years. They've spoken out on behalf of human rights and self-determination for Tibet. The Dalai Lama, in fact, spoke here at the Commonwealth Club on October 3rd of 1979 during his first visit to the United States. So it is my very great pleasure today to introduce today's special guest, who I learned also has spoken here previously a couple of times at the Commonwealth Club, Dr. Robert Thurman. He is a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University, president of the Tibet House U.S., and co-author of the new book, Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. The Dalai Lama is one of the most insightful leaders of the modern era. His emphasis on nonviolent protest, compassion, and reason are the foundation of his teachings. He was a tireless advocate for many decades for freedom and self-determination for Tibet. With these values, Dr. Thurman believes there is a powerful hope for reconciliation, peace, and enlightenment. And in his graphic book, Professor Thurman gives the detailed life story of the 14th Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso, from his early childhood and escape into exile, his conflicts with the Chinese Communist Party, and finally, his role as a truly global inspirational figure with special insight on Tibetan culture and identity. Dr. Thurman has spread Buddhist teachings in the West and has authored several books on Tibet, Buddhism, and most recently about his good friend, the 14th Dalai Lama. Dr. Thurman is also the first Westerner to be ordained a Tibetan Buddhist monk by the Dalai Lama. Dr. Thurman's work, as well as the Dalai Lama's, speaks to many of the tensions and challenges facing us in the world today. Please welcome Dr. Robert Thurman.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you. Thank you, Gloria. And I discovered that Gloria herself is a graduate of Columbia University in political science, and I was actually enjoying listening to you.
Well, and I was regretting having left too early or being too old to have been one of your students.
That's great. Well, I missed being your student, but that's now I am your student now.
And
so
it's
very nice to see everybody. So do you have questions, or you want me to just sort of get going?
Would you like to just start off?
And okay.
I certainly have many questions.
Yeah, so I'm very happy to see all of you here today, and I'm hoping that, of course, you will discover this book and the history of the Dalai Lama. And I imagine a number of you already know quite a lot about the Dalai Lama. And the question I've had from a number of people about the book is several. Why a graphic novel? Or some people say, why don't you call it a graphic biography? Because it is actually based on the autobiographies of the Dalai Lama. And nobody's really written a sort of outsider's biography particularly much, mostly autobiographies. And the answer to that is twofold. My colleague, William Myers, who was one of the co-authors with me, his wife, first wife, died of cancer years ago, but she prolonged her life, she thought, at least by the help of the Dalai Lama. She went to Dharamsala, and the Tibetan physician helped her extend her life. She had been given a few months to live, actually, in America at the time, and then she went there and lived 3 or 4 years. And during that time, she felt very grateful, had a happy time, not very painful. And so she started the idea. She had children with William Myers, and they had several kids, and then she was working on trying to bring the Dalai Lama's life to light for younger people. And so that was where the idea of doing the giant comic book, you know, like this kind of thing came from. And in my case also, it's not only reaching the younger people, but I believe a lot of the older people don't really know the Dalai Lama in detail. And also what people really know is the first part, you know, where he escaped from the first, he tried to get along. You know, he sometimes says he's a Marxist, especially to annoy capitalists if he meets them. He loves to be a little provocative. And he did hang out with Mao a little bit. And actually, more importantly, which I show in the book, he hung out with Xi Jinping, the current president of China's father, and who Xi Zhongxiong, who was an important official at that time in 1954. Dalai Lama was 19. And he spent 11 months in China and mostly in Beijing. Mao, you know, trying to convince him because the Chinese weren't really ready to manage Tibet right away without the cooperation of Tibetans. They had to build a road system, which they did using a little bit slave labor of the Tibetans. And they had to get their troops in there, et cetera, solidly. So they were kind of making nice at the beginning somewhat, at least in central Tibet. And during that time, the father of Xi Jinping became very close to the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama gave him a gold watch, and the Xi family told the Dalai Lama's sister in the 80s, when they were thinking of going back maybe, and they were thinking that Deng Xiaoping would make a decent deal with them, which unfortunately didn't happen ultimately. But during that time, she told Dalai Lama's sister that this was a family treasure, you know, and was kept like in their little shrine in their house. And Xi Jinping himself was said to have been annoyed when Deng Xiaoping put his father along with Hu Yaobang, you know, the more liberal leader in the early 80s of China, who was later busted by Deng and Jiang for being too nice to the minorities and to the Tibetans especially. Hu Yaobang felt, he was the one who wept when he went to Tibet in the early 80s, and he said that we made a terrible mess here, and this is awful, we've destroyed this culture, and he changed the policy, and they expected the Tibetans to go out and start making some truck gardens and do something economic, you know, make some restaurants, which they did, but they also went out and started rebuilding temples like mad and becoming monks and nuns, which they were scratching their heads about. The Chinese, they were so puzzled. Why did they want to go back to this terrible, parasitical, you know, obsolete, outmoded religious culture that they loved? And Deng only allowed that to happen for about 4 or 5 years. And then he put down Xi Jinping's father and Hu Yaobang and sort of, took away their ability to do that, and then started being harsh again with the Tibetans when the Dalai Lama, in fact, didn't go back. I have a scene in here that I enjoyed putting, where the Dalai Lama, you know, on this page here, where when we heard that Xi Jinping had become president of China now in 2012, and Dalai Lama was at a party there, and we were chatting, and he was telling me the story about how he was fond of Xi Zhongxiong. And so here the Dalai Lama is musing. Then I later discovered, his holiness didn't think of that when we had that conversation, but I later realized that Xi Jinping was born in 1953. So at that time he was 1 year old. And then I have the Dalai Lama musing, did he bring his boy over to see me, you know, and did it maybe get a blessing, but you couldn't openly do it because he's a communist, right? 1954, you have to like be very anti-spiritual. But obviously he would bring a one-year-old son to see, since he was very fond of the Dalai Lama. So here's this sort of maybe happened but I think definitely did. But anyway, maybe happened event of the current president of China being blessed at 1 year of age by the 19-year-old Dalai Lama. You know? So this is the kind of detail that somehow gets there, coming from the personal, you know, I have known His Holiness for 53 years. And initially, I was not really his student, actually, because he was more interested in, I was fluent in Tibetan by the time I met him. And he was very interested in knowing, you know, about Freud and about physics and about how plutonium detonates a nuclear weapon and the bicameral system. He's very into democracy, you know. So he was downloading my sort of Exeter, Harvard smattering of education. And then he would say, when I would ask him a Buddhist question, he would say, well, go see my teacher, so-and-so. You know? So we were kind of fellow students, you know. And then later on, we kind of got where we debate with each other a little bit. Tibetans, maybe some of you know, if you know a little bit about Tibetan culture, you know, in their education system, they have this very energetic debating system where they clap their hands and shout and get all excited and argue things with very strong emotion, because they feel that you have to defend your worldview or seek a new worldview, seek a deeper truth, bringing your emotion into your debate. Sort of like, you know, and colleges, good colleges, liberal colleges and high schools, where the students debate at home about, you know, did Tolstoy really mean this or did Shakespeare mean that, you know, and they get all excited, you know, in their thing. In fact, when I was a monk and I went to one of the big Tibetan monasteries down in the South India that the Dalai Lama reconstructed in his amazing reconstruction of these little enclaves of Tibetan civilization outside of Tibet. And I thought a riot was going outside about after tea. First day I visited, it sounded, there was this tremendous hubbub. And I said, is there something wrong? You know, like my host, you know, I said, he said, oh, no, that's just the evening debate. And I went outside and there was long row, hundreds of these young monks, and they were like arguing away and they were clapping and like this and that. And they were just completely flipping out, kind of, you know, with behind, you know, emptiness and selflessness and how can it relate to compassion and why would that make people compassionate, emptiness, if we don't get that, and then debating, you know, and it's marvelous how they do that, actually. And it's, you know, adolescent Americans, I think, who debate like that would probably come to fisticuffs, I think, rather soon. But they keep it very controlled. But they do like this, you know, they clap in each other's face and they're very forceful emotionally and very engaged in their thing. It's really wonderful. So anyway, Dalai Lama likes to do that with me. If I say something, he says, what is that? No, he allows me to do that with him, or somehow I do. And secretaries look a little, but he likes it, actually. And I think he's not used to it in a little bit.
Let's start back when you first met him. Can you tell us about the circumstances in which you met the Dalai Lama for the first time?
Which time we met? Well, it's in the book, actually. I tried not to let myself be put in, but my co-writers insisted that it would be important to put a few things. So they show me with my head shaved, and I came with an old Mongolian lama who was my root original teacher and from whom I learned the language, who'd lived 35 years in Tibet. And he introduced me to the Dalai Lama and he said, oh, this boy is really smart and he speaks already Tibetan and he really wants to be a Buddhist monk and he really loves Buddhism and he's very sincere. But, you know, like all those American boys, he's a little crazy and a little proud, you know, but you know, I want you to take charge of him. And said, but one thing, don't make him a monk. He wants to be a monk. He's very determined and he's sincere about it. It's not some pretense. But don't make him a monk because, you know what, in the future he won't be able to stay a monk in America. It won't work out. And Dalai Lama, said Dalai Lama, listen to that. And then he said, well, I'm just an old Mongolian lama. You're the Dalai Lama, whatever you decide. So then that delayed me getting to be a monk about 8 months. I sort of got investigated. And then he finally did. And then my old lama was right. And eventually I resigned as a monk because coming back in America in the mid-60s, all my peers were marching in the South with civil rights. They were protesting the war, you know. They were a little bit stoned, a lot of them, you know. And by that time, I was not getting stoned, and I was like a big meditator, and so I wanted them to learn to meditate instead of getting too stoned, even though sometimes getting stoned the right way is a little bit meditative, actually. But I wasn't going for that at that time. And so then my original Mongolian friend, I was back there, he said, well, you can't go out and be an activist and march with your friends against the war as a Buddhist monk because, you know, we don't do that. And so either you stay here or you can go there. And then, of course, when I went out, then sooner or later, we didn't have Hare Krishna people in the airports at that time. There was no understanding. And years later, my daughter looked at pictures of me. She said, oh, look, Daddy looks like Henry Miller in drag. So it didn't quite fit, you know, with the American culture. And then, unfortunately, or fortunately for me, shortly after not being a monk, I fell in love with someone, you know, and then I had so many children. And actually, my collegial friends, my academic friends, professors and things, they were really worried. They'd say, what is it with you ex-monks? I have, you know, five children. And like, what is that?
Making
what
up for lost time.
What?
Making up for lost time.
I guess so. I guess so. But at the time, and His Holiness, when we first met, was in Sarnath, which is the place where Buddha gave his original teaching. To the first five ascetics, you know, he turned the wheel, they say, he turned the wheel of Dharma of the Four Noble Truths. And His Holiness was making his first, in a way, big presentation to the World Fellowship of Buddhists conference, Buddhist monks from all over Asia. And I noted to my distress, after having met him, just before he gave this talk, that they were looking very skeptically, because other Buddhists in Asia at that time, Tibetan Buddhism had a kind of negative reputation. They thought maybe it's a mixture of shamanism, which was wasn't liked at that time, and they didn't realize what it was. And then they thought maybe in the Tantra, you know, it's kind of weird. And you know, they were the Theravadins, you know, in Burma and Sri Lanka, and they're Mahayana in China, but they don't have much Tantra. The Shingon people in Japan are the only other ones. And so, and then they were saying, oh, he's not so bad. Oh, he's a monk, really. Oh, that's great. And he was kind of winning them over while I was listening to his talk, you know. And then he took me back to Dharamsala, and then I became this Henry Miller in drag pretty soon. I had a red robe, shaved head, and I was very rigid as a monk. I wouldn't have a bite. I would starve after 12:01 p.m. I wouldn't have lunch. Had to have before noon, you know, and this kind of thing. And I think I was a little irritating to Tibetans who are a little more relaxed, you know. I even told there's a scene in here where I sell to the Dalai Lama. I say, well, Your Holiness, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha left his throne and his lay position in society, and he just became a Dharma teacher. You know, he taught the Dharma and founded the tradition. So why don't you just, you know, China, Tibet, it's a big problem. Just give up the government. And let the Tibetans manage, and you just be a world guru. You know, I'm sure you'll do a great job. And he said, nothing he'd like better. But if he did it, the Tibetans would feel betrayed and abandoned. He had to speak for them. He had to save them. And I was too, you know, I was a super monk, so I wouldn't listen, you know. And years, but he didn't mind. His secretaries were furious. They wanted to throw me out of the audience room. But he was fine. He's so sweet, you know. And later, much later, I realized what an important role he occupies in his country and how important. And then nowadays he teases me. He says, you are the most enthusiastic about monasticism ex-monk that I know.
So
he was a little annoyed at first when I quit. But later he appreciated I became a professor and we worked together on many things.
I noticed that there's a little bit of self-deprecating humor in the portrait of you in the book. As you mentioned, enthusiastic, ready to be a monk right then, and so on. As you moved on through your relationship with the Dalai Lama, did you become more politically active? Did you speak out in terms of Tibet and the human rights situation?
Yes, well, at the time, you know, at one point, like initially, I was not really involved in the political aspect, and I sort of thought, well, it sort of happened, you know. Yes, it's unfair, and of course I knew the Tibetans were Tibet, and they had their own country, and it was 100% not China, and it was a really unpleasant thing, and so on, you know, that was going on. But I didn't think it was doable, and as I said, I was leaving the world being a monk, so I wasn't really paying attention to it. And His Holiness himself was very against the guerrilla effort that was being made by some Tibetans, including some of his brothers. He was not in favor of that. He never did. He was inspired by Gandhi. And I show that in the book, how he debates with the brothers, but in a way he can't stop them because the way it worked, he's not, you know, people wrongly think Dalai Lama has such a power over the Tibetans, but he doesn't. They adore him and they love him and they say, "Yes, Your Holiness, yes, Your Holiness," and then they run out and have a beer, you know. And then they, you know, some do, some try to be very correct, and there are many young Tibetan monks, with a surprising large number of them, and they're very sincere and they study very hard and they've kept the tradition alive in a beautiful manner, actually. They've used the adversity of their exile and their poverty of being coming out with nothing of their country to really develop their spiritual thing very strongly. And it's amazing what he's done. And that's another thing that was not really shown. And it, because, again, he doesn't ever like to show himself doing something really quite heroic and quite extraordinary as a social organizer and keeping his community going in exile and supporting all of them. He's like the mother of the whole, you know, 100, 150,000 people in Nepal and Tibet and then in Switzerland and then around the world. Mm-hmm. And he treats everyone, as they say about a Buddha sees every living being like a mother sees their only beloved child. You know, that is the nature of enlightenment, they say. And he's like that, you know, Dalai Lama.
Now, in 2011, he formally gave up his political responsibility. Can you tell us what that means? How did that come about?
Right.
And who takes on that responsibility?
Well, it's not clear. You know, he did keep it all through this time, although he basically tried to train the Tibetans in democracy from the very beginning in the late 50s, early 60s. You know, he came out in 59, and then right away he started making a constitution, conferring with Indian constitutional lawyers and Europeans and a few Americans, but mostly Europeans and Indians. And then he was having the Tibet vote, and they had a Supreme Court and the government exile, etc. But somehow the Tibetans were used to somehow having kind of a lama tell them, like, "Be cool." They weren't used to the idea of a loyal opposition. They would get very partisan. They're very individualistic Tibetans. People think they're sort of holy, holy. Maybe some people do, but they are. They can be, and they're extraordinary, some of them. But there is a saying they have themselves, when there's 20 Tibetans in a room, there are 40 horns, like yaks, you know. And yaks are never completely domesticated. You know, they're the cow family, but they're kind of there. In Wyoming, someone told me that when there's a few people who raise yaks in Wyoming, they've imported a few yaks, and the local ranchers call them, "Oh, them long-haired hippie cattle." What are you doing with them long-haired hippie cattle? You know, because they're that big wool thing, you know. And so Tibetans are semi-nomadic, you know, half of them or more are nomads. And nomads tend to be kind of individualistic, you know. And also nomad women tend to be very, very strong-minded because they are the ones who have to wrangle the yaks, you know. Guys are off trading for salt and going on missions like that. And so they are wonderful. They have wonderful personalities. And they were great warriors, you know. Tibet had a huge empire in the first millennium. And it was through having that empire and conquering the Silk Route. They conquered China at one time, Tang Dynasty China, and they changed the rulers. The ruler wasn't paying them tribute to their satisfaction. And they conquered in Bengal and what is now Bhutan and Nepal and even into northern Pakistan. And yet, after about 1,000 years of Buddhism, they demilitarized and they became really vulnerable like they have been up into modern times. And the Dalai Lama government changed the role of the aristocrats to being bureaucrats in the same century as Louis XIV did. Mm-hmm. You know, did you ever wonder why Louis XIV made such a big long-term party in Versailles and Fontainebleau and these places for the barons from Burgundy and Provence and these places? Because he wanted them to come and have a Hotel de Ville in Paris and want to serve the government, and he didn't want them to rebel provincially and create. So it was nation building, you know. And the fifth Dalai Lama did that in the 17th century in Tibet. And otherwise the robber barons, you know, become a little hard to manage from the center, you know, unless they're living in town where you can catch them if they behave. And he took away their private armies, actually, the fifth Dalai Lama, and then basically everybody became monks. Imagine a country with 15% of the people being monks and nuns. And that it has a good byproduct in population balance, you know. because they don't have children, and that ecology is very delicate, Tibet. You can't really have an intensive population, as the Chinese are discovering with their futile attempts to colonize it, with people from low altitude who can't manage the high altitude, and it will fail. You know, their attempt to do that, it would be ruinous, actually. So therefore, in the long run, everything will be fine. Don't worry. Don't look worried thinking about the suffering of Tibet, although we should. They are badly suffering still now, but they'll be fine in the long term. We're confident.
So there are a lot of questions about the future of the position or role of Dalai Lama.
Yes, of course. Yeah, my friend Mickey Lemley made a film called The Last Dalai Lama, which relates to a confusion in the sense that the Dalai Lama is the reincarnation of the Avalokiteshvara, or the Tibetans say Chenrezig, who is supposedly the incarnation of the compassion of infinite Buddhas. And so that reincarnation of that bodhisattva, the way the Tibetans view it, is never ending. It doesn't end. And so the Dalai Lama has a vow he will reincarnate as long as beings are suffering himself. And there are other incarnations. It's a little hard for us to understand in the West, you know, Christian West, where, you know, there's this one Messiah, you know. And this is very puzzling for Tibetans. I was once translating for a Lama in an interreligious conference, and he was asking a Lutheran theologian, like, how come your God is omnipotent, right? Yes. Well, how come he only has one son? And then the big theological explanation, I tried to translate into Tibetan. And then the Lama asks, well, how many children do you have? I have five, says the guy. And you have five and God can only have one? And it went on like that, you know. It sort of went on. And then finally, he couldn't, because the Tibetans, the idea is that the benevolent beings, not necessarily, there is no omnipotent God from their point of view, but there are gods. And there are very benevolent ones. There also are demons and bad ones. But none of them are omnipotent powered, you know, in the Tibetan view. They relativize them, you know. They don't disbelieve, they're not atheists, but they're relative theists, let's say. And they don't blame one God for the mess. You could say. And in the Buddhist literature, that God talks to Buddha and he says, please tell people not to blame me for the mess. I do my best. I'm very powerful. I would like to help everybody, but I don't want to be blamed for it. So why did I launch into that? I forgot.
There's a Lama recognized by and appointed by the Chinese government.
Oh, yes. So
what,
right,
about
so,
the lineage so, of
yeah,
the
so he can't Dalai stop Lama. Incarnating Dalai Lama. When he says last Dalai Lama, you know, he retired at 81 or 80, and he thought he would have an experiment to see if Tibetans will practice complete democracy, where they were doing democracy, but he still would appoint certain important people. And also there was the idea of a Lama kind of, you know, calming them down when they get mad with each other, you know, and debate too much, the lay people, you know, in the parliament that they had. So he thought, let them go for it themselves, and he resigned. And then he was also very happy. He said, I've been a hypocrite all this time. I've been talking about democracy and all that, and yet I've still appointed some of the leaders. Now I'm great. He made a speech in Washington in 2011, I think, where he was very happy. And then he spoke to the people in Tibet through the Voice of America, and he reassured the Tibetans that he was stepping out of the government in exile didn't mean he was giving up supporting and speaking for them and so on. He would be even more energetic, but he just wouldn't have an official role. And then he made the parliament in exile write down that he would not, his successor after reincarnating, whenever it happens in the future, may it be many decades from now, would not be dragooned into serving in the government. And I argued with him about it, and I said, Your Holiness, that's terrible. Tibetans will need you. You don't have to have an office like a bureaucrat, and you don't have to make that kind of decision. They can elect people, a prime minister. But you should be like the English queen or the Norwegian king, sort of a symbol for them. And he said, I don't want to be a prisoner like Lady Di. He did. And I said, well, you don't, but maybe the young Dalai Lama wouldn't mind. And then I said, because Tibetans might start fighting each other and then also selling the trees or, you know, being like doing business. The merchants will come and bribe the Congress people. You know? I said, in America, you think we have full democracy. But I said, we have in America, unfortunately, a little too much mammonocracy. He says, what is that? I said, well, it's a kind of theocracy where we worship the god Mammon, which means money. Oh, he said, I get that. He said, I think we see that going on today, don't we? Oligarchs, the role of the oligarchs here. So I said, it's very important, therefore, to have a symbol that's in the people's face a little bit. He said, no, Tibetans will never be like that. They're too religious. And then I said, Your Holiness, they're too religious because you've been sitting on their head for 350 years. You know. And then he said, well, you know what I have to say to that? He says, shut up. This is how we relate. Meaning, and what he said, what he meant by that, he said, what I mean is, don't go giving the Tibetans ideas. Right. He said, if they come up on their own where they want to draft my successor someday, when Tibet is truly autonomous, you know, free within its own space, but under China, which is his position. That's what he wants. He doesn't want to separate from China, but he also wants real autonomy on their own plateau, you know, because China doesn't know how to manage that plateau, and they're ruining it actually really badly. And so then he said, so don't go, I shouldn't really be saying this because some Tibetans might hear it, and then they'll say, oh, we'll get the Dalai Lama back, you know. Because he told the parliament he absolutely won't serve next life, anything, no way. So it's not the last in that sense, but the last having a political role.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program. You, in your book, portrayed the violence that has occurred in Tibet.
Yes.
Shall I say graphically? After all, it's a graphic book, but it's very graphic.
Yes.
Many, many, many episodes of
yes.
killings and purges and atrocities and so
yes.
on.
Yes.
First of all, why did you do that? It seems like you're really trying to educate about the details of what have happened.
Yes.
And secondly, tell us what you think about the political status of Tibet today. How are things
yes.
there?
Well, that was one of the reasons. You know, we felt, my co-authors and myself, we felt that you can't appreciate the Dalai Lama's nonviolent leadership. In the world leadership, really, as if people know him around the world. You can't appreciate it without realizing that this is in reaction to what normally would create a very strong wish for violence and revenge. A lot of atrocities did happen. But, you know, there's factions amongst the Tibetans who feel like that they don't want to embarrass the Chinese. You know, they don't want to, we call it the appeasement faction. And they feel maybe they'll be nice if we don't embarrass them, you know, and maybe they'll change their mind, you know. We don't want to play the victim, and so we don't really want to tell this, you know. There's no Tibetan Solzhenitsyn. There are some, that show the disaster of Mao and things for the Chinese people and for the people they conquered, Mongolians, Uyghurs, Manchus, and Tibetans. Those four types of people are not really Chinese people, and they're not treated by Chinese people as Chinese people. Even no matter what they say, they don't treat them like that. They treat them as lesser, you know. And so, therefore, that's why we called it a graphic novel, and that's why we did it without, you know, having Dalai Lama write four words and do things like that, because we wanted him to have deniability. Oh, some students and friends of mine, they went off and they decided they had to really tell the story. And I was very nervous about it, actually, that some people in the government in exile would be upset. But I was encouraged toward the end. His Holiness said in Paris, around the time we finally finished and we were about to issue the book, he did say, I wasn't there, but I saw it online. He said in the Paris Parliament, in the French Parliament, he said, well, you know, Tibetans are suffering so badly, they are burning, and they can't even show their smoke. And so it's up to people who know the true story to tell the truth to the world, he said. So I was so pleased, you know, because then I figured, although there might be people who are annoyed by it, I mean, it's necessary, I think. We have to show, you know, it's like Holocaust denying otherwise, you know, because it was a kind of, it has been, it continues to be actually, kind of at least ethnocide, you know, ethnic cleansing thing, or you could say genocide, because foolishly, you know, they think that, you know, They know that they didn't own Tibet, actually. It was never part of China. They know that. They claim, oh, yes. But the Mongolians were not Chinese either. And they conquered China and Tibet. And it's like the British once owned the U.S. and Canada. So therefore, we should be owned by Canada? I don't think so, you know. And the British are not Americans, you know. They're British. It's a thing like that. And then the Manchus are also not Chinese, and they were very rude. Chinese would say, oh, it's the Westerners who made us a century of humiliation and torture. Actually, the Manchus humiliated them for 350 years, who are like a forest people from north, like north of Korea. They're not actually Chinese people. And they treated the Chinese, they dragged them around by the pigtails for hundreds of years. They didn't intermarry with them. They treated them as a low caste people, you know. So, you know, they know that, so they know that their claim they always own China is false. They actually all know that. So then they don't believe that there could be a leader like the Dalai Lama who would say, well, we like the Chinese. We like Chinese food. We like you. We have plenty of room. And actually, we don't worry about you overwhelming us with population, because you would have been there thousands of years ago with your tens of millions in those days, or hundreds of millions in those days, on our huge plateau as big as the whole U.S. west of the Mississippi, or all of Western Europe. You would have been there if you could live in that altitude, which you can't. You know, you get chronic mountain sickness, and you have heart disease, and women can't form placenta, so they can't, you know, propagate. You know, they have to go. The wives of officials, Chinese officials stationed in Tibet, are sent down low altitude to gestate there when they become pregnant. You know, so it just won't be colonizable. That's why it isn't colonized, and only 6 million people live there on this huge place. So they can't believe that Dalai Lama would be happy to be part of a Chinese union, you know, like Hong Kong, one country, two systems. And that would solve the Taiwan problem. Then if Taiwan could be one country, two systems, and Mongolia could be one country, and then it would be fine. They wouldn't have to worry about some sort of, like, we own everybody, and everybody else who doesn't say so, we're going to kill them. You know, that's a 18th century, is it? 17th? It's not 21st century, you know. It isn't. And so His Holiness definitely truly means it. And even I would say they know that the Dalai Lama wants to be part of China. He feels China is a huge economy. Chinese were Buddhist. When the Manchu emperors patronized Tibet, it was doing fine. And Tibet did a job for them, kept the peace with the Mongolians and with different people, and didn't militarize. You know, the Chinese have that wall against the nomadic type of people. And that's because they have a long history of being predated upon by them. So the Dalai Lama made peace in Central Asia. Turkish, you know, Uyghur, Turkish and Mongolians and Tibetans no longer attacking China. So they very much patronized Buddhism and patronized them. And so, they, you know, the China could be Buddhist again, will be Buddhist again for sure when the Communist Party kind of decides to go multi-party, you know, which is it feels confident enough to do that. And if hopefully they do it before the people get too mad with them for their prison system and the whole thing. And it'll be nice. And then they can go, Russia, you have, well, we don't want the Chinese KGB to keep charge like in Russia. But it has, you know, Gorbachev's, you know, opening didn't work too well. But I think Xi Jinping is what's going to work. Xi Jinping, who was blessed at 1 year old by Dalai Lama, we feel quite likely in his second 5-year term, he will change the policy with minorities into a pleasant one. And he will get good public relations advice, which I'm happy to offer free of charge, about how soft power means you have to show a soft side. You can't be harsh and a violent oppressor and then tell people you're soft and everybody's happy when they aren't. It doesn't work. You just have to really, nowadays, especially Facebook is in everybody's face, you know. Everybody knows whenever anybody sprains their ankle on the other side of the planet. Much less, when some people don't know what's right in front of them, like, you know, governor of Florida over there dancing with Irma, he knows there's no climate change. Yeah. He knows that. He's not changing his mind. Excuse me. Can't help myself.
For our audience not with us in San Francisco, this is the broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California.
Okay.
We're speaking today with Professor Robert Thurman from Columbia University, professor of Indo-Buddhist Tibetan Studies. Could you talk about the Four Noble Truths and why they're called truths? Let's go into Buddhist philosophy.
Well, I think they're called truth is not a wrong translation for the Sanskrit word satya. But satya can also mean, you know, truth in English though has a double meaning, where it can mean a propositional truth, like a verbal thing. And I think the reason they use that word, the early translators, 19th century from Buddhist texts, is that they were thinking Buddhism is a religion, and so they have to have a credo, they have to have something they believe in. But the Four Noble Truths, which was the Buddha's first and most enduring framework teaching, is not really something to believe in. You know, the first one is the truth of suffering, meaning, but doesn't mean that all life is suffering, as poor Pope Benedict thought. He was so unhappy for Buddhas, thinking they were all miserable because life is suffering, you know. But Buddha didn't say life is suffering. He said unenlightened life is suffering. Just like Socrates said, you know, unexamined life is not worth living. Buddha never said unenlightened life is not worth living. He just said it'll be frustrating. You'll never get quite what you want. You know, something will go wrong. You're going to get sick. You're going to die. You're going to lose your friends. Different things are going to happen. You know, you're going to get a king or a president that you don't like. You know, things are going to happen. So it's going to be frustrating if you're unenlightened. And then he said the reason for that is not just that the outer world is no good and God didn't make it right. You know, didn't do a good job. It's the reason for that is that your own perception of yourself and your world is misinformed. You have a certain misknowledge, a misunderstanding about what you are. And what is the misunderstanding? The second noble truth is very simple. Each person thinks they are the main thing. Like right here in this room, I'm here, I'm at my Commonwealth Club talk, you know, I'm the main, and gee whiz, I'm not in the front row, and I'm not talking. And the thing is, when you think you're the main thing, you're also a little nervous because you know nobody else agrees. Not only that, they think they're the main thing. And they know you don't agree with them. Actually, Mom agreed for a little while. And then occasionally, you know, honeymoon, you know, oh, you're the one. And hopefully you both agree with each other that they're the other one is the one, temporarily. And that's why everybody else hates that kind of a loving couple, you know. They have Romeo and Juliet, you know, they do them in, you know, because they're in this wonderful delusion of like, they love, the other one is the greatest, you know. So soon they, of course, learn, you know, and that they got to learn how to figure out how to get along. Anyway, and my wife and I just had 50th anniversary, so.
Congratulations.
She says, I'm still only semi-trained. Since men only emerge from adolescence at around 60. And I'm in my 70s now, so I guess I'm like beyond teenage, but still have a lot to learn. So, you know, we male chauvinist Americans, you guys are Californians, so I'm sure you're better. So that's the third. Then the third noble truth is the one that Buddha really intended. And that was really his discovery. And that's the truth of nirvana. So that's like the prognosis. So the first noble truth is the recognition of a symptom. You're going to be frustrated if you think you're the center. The second one is the diagnosis, because you think you're the center of it and you really aren't. And you have to correct that, you know. And you don't correct it. People wrongly misunderstand Buddhism in the West by thinking that the way you correct the feeling of being in the center is you have a big eureka, you don't exist. And they wrongly think that's what emptiness means, and that's totally incorrect. That's why would an Indian person or anybody listen to somebody who said, Eureka, I don't exist. If you don't exist, why don't you shut up? You know? What are you talking about? So what you don't is you don't exist as the center of the world. You exist as a relational being interrelated with other beings. You're not, though. My old Mongolian teacher used to say, long before the Matrix movie, he used to say, everybody goes around secretly thinking, I'm the one. You know, before Neo discovered he was the one, remember? And he said, but the solution is not to think that you don't exist. The solution is to discover that you're only one of the ones. and be responsible for being the one of the ones that you are. And then it turns out that when you realize that, and you realize that there's so many other ones, and that you will be much happier when you make them happier, then you become compassionate as well as wise, you know. So, and then that's nirvana, you know, that's what he called nirvana. And that was his discovery. He wouldn't have even breathed a word of his results of his meditation if he didn't discover that everything is all right, actually. If we just correct, if human beings learn, and human beings are well positioned because they're highly educable. They can be self-critical, they can look into their own nature and the way it works, and they can see their exaggerated sense of self, or some of them can, not maybe some of the reality TV stars, but other people can, and they can figure out they're not the center of it, you know. And human beings especially can do that. You know, tigers and lions and deers, etc. And the Buddha was like Darwin. He noticed that everybody is totally interconnected to all the animals, and even more intimately than Darwin, because not only are we our genes descended from chimpanzees and all kinds of crocodiles and whatever, but we were personally chimpanzees and crocodiles in previous lives from Buddha's biological point of view. The karma is a biological theory. And we became this amazing, weird, non-crocodile human, you know? And it's, we're not as effective in a swamp as a crocodile. But of course, we can invent a crocodile gun, of course, and be worse than a crocodile. But that's only because we can learn to listen to our wives and invent something different, you know? And talk with each other. And the reason we can talk with each other is we don't eat each other the minute we meet. Like animals do. You know, we have time for chatting. And that's the fourth. So then the fourth noble truth, then, is the education system of how you... So it's not something to believe. And even Nirvana, he said, I can say, Nirvana, I discovered everything's fine. Don't worry, we'll all be fine sooner or later. You'll find us out. And I see that you will, for sure. I can see the future, how it works, because he was super smart. And he became much more so when he expanded his sense of identification to identify with everyone. He then had a bigger database of feeling he was all the other people and beings. And but, you know, we have to re-educate ourselves. And then there's eight sort of steps of that re-education: ethical education, psychological education, that's where the meditation comes in, and scientific education, where wisdom, because wisdom is scientific. Buddhist wisdom is scientific. It is not believing something. It's learning and knowing something. And it's like science. It's discovering what is real and distinguishing it from what is unreal. And that's why Buddhism always got along in China, India, wherever it is, with the local religion. It didn't insist that people change that. In fact, it's fine, they can keep their thing. Although it did relativize anything sort of absolutist in the local religion. You know, it could cause people to be a little more relaxed about it, you know. But it didn't change. And Dalai Lama's like that, you know. That's another thing people don't know about Dalai Lama, which I show here, how he is not trying to make people into Buddhists. He has been, for decades, since the 60s, he has been telling the leaders of other world religions, please don't rush around converting people. We won't do that, and you shouldn't do that. And it's not good in a modern situation where you have pluralism and the same city has synagogues and churches and temples and mosques and so forth, that each one is trying to get the followers of the other and win them over, sort of increase their market share. That's a bad thing. So he always says that. You must have heard him. Probably many of you, I'm sure, have heard him here at the Greek Theater or somewhere. He always says, you know, reality doesn't belong to any religion, you know. And although you may learn something from whatever I may tell you about your mind or about some practice that you can do, how to be more compassionate or something, keep it in your own grandmother's religious cultural framework. Don't upset grandma and run into grandma and say, I'm a Buddhist now, grandma. She'll be upset. And don't upset her, you know. But try to be a better Christian. And I'm going to learn from you Christians how to build hospitals and how to do, like, deal with the homeless and how to have soup kitchens. We Buddhist monks have been too lazy about that. And we've, you know, taken it for granted, because actually Buddhism arose in more wealthy societies than the West, than the deserts of the Middle East and or Greece and so forth, and Rome. There was much wealth. India was hugely wealthy, in China too, much more so in ancient Eurasia. And therefore, they were more relaxed. The authorities were more relaxed about people getting a free lunch. You know, we live in America, except in a no-free lunch Protestant ethics society, so we don't understand monasticism and this kind of thing, you know. So this is the kind of detail that this book shows people. And I've been delighted that some older people who know the Dalai Lama's autobiographies and have read them, but then they admit, confess to me when they get this. They say, well, you know, I sort of petered out when we got into the 60s or into the 70s, and what he's been doing the last decades, I'm not quite sure. And also, everybody thinks he's so sweet and nice, Dalai Lama, but his nonviolence is so unrealistic and so impractical. Tibet is never going to get there, and oh, it's all finished, and we shouldn't even bother with that. You know, they all think like that. And actually, that's not the case. And I always like to say to them, well, Tibet is still in a terrible situation, and they haven't ever had an army for hundreds of years, and they did try a little guerrilla thing for a while, and it didn't work out. Dalai Lama told them, please don't do that. And his brothers managed it. That's in the book, you know. But he couldn't stop them, and they did it. But it didn't work, and he said it wouldn't work, and it quit. You know, Nixon and Kissinger put a stop to it to make business with China, you know. And in the early 70s, as the Dalai Lama predicted they would. And so they say that, but then I have what my answer to that is. Dalai Lama is more polite. He doesn't say much. He'll be quiet when people say that. He'll say, maybe I failed or something. He'll be like that. You know, he's nicer than me, luckily. But I say, how are they doing in Afghanistan with the violence? Is that working well? How about the Middle East? Is that doing well? You know, where has violence been so great? You know, well, we say the World War. And yes, there was a seeming victory of some kind. But, you know, the world has had hundreds of wars since then. You know, the UN has failed. The victors of the World War, who are the veto power people in the UN, are the biggest arms dealers on the planet. And they're shipping them by the busload to Africa and everywhere. And they're saying, oh, those people, really, they're shooting each other. Well, who's shipping them all the weapons, selling them to them, is the five victors of the World War, right? I mean, you're a political scientist. You know better than me that history. You know, at one point I was going to make a film with the Dalai Lama. We had it all set, and somebody in the government exile put a stop to it, unfortunately. His Holiness wanted to do it on the arms trade, and, you know, with the Swedish Institute and studying this. This is Cyprus. Very destructive. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go in a marketplace in Cameroon or in East Africa and Kenya and Somalia, and you can find, like, Kalashnikovs, like iPhones just lying around on tables. We can buy them for $20 or $50, you know, and ammunition. Well, everywhere. And all these unstable places, you know. And we're responsible for that. We and, you know, our buddies, other Security Council peacekeepers. And so that's another reason, you know, the Dalai Lama's thing, the nonviolent thing, is actually practical. He wants to talk to the Chinese. Turns out the new president's father was a close friend of his. And the new president had said his father was unjustly treated by Deng Xiaoping for being kind to the Tibetans. So there is hope, you know. And we end the book on the visions of the Dalai Lama's vision for the future of Tibet, which I've always said to those who are involved in the political thing about Tibet, you know, lobbying and so forth, that, you know, Tibet cannot be internally free, no matter who has the sovereignty, you know, on paper. But it can't be internally free until the world system changes. And people do decide that violent conflict is really, you know, the winner loses. So there's no point in it. And therefore, dialogue becomes mandatory, which the Dalai Lama has said many times for decades, should be the main thing of the 21st century. It's like nobody picks up the gun, you know. Everybody, you know, I always like to say, I have a slogan about it, actually, which I don't put in this book because it's my slogan, it's not His Holiness, but I say we have to shift from mad to mud. And as you know, mad is mutual assured destruction, and I think Gloria worked on arms things and most very knowledgeable, much more than me, about that, about the denuclearization thing that we thought was going in the right direction until just lately. We're a little worried, but I think it will, basically. This is just a blip. It's a New York blip, and I apologize. And although there are some people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it's not quite only New York. And so the point is, if a victor loses, you know, mud means you have a bunch of poker players, And, you know, they used to get mad and turn over the table and pull out their pistols, you know, their derringers, and shoot each other, you know. And now the poker players are in a situation where each one has a pistol at the other one's temple, and that's wired in permanently. So even if somebody squeezes the trigger, the death throw of the other one will squeeze the trigger and everybody's gone. So in that situation, it's a waste of money to build up arms, you know. It's a complete ridiculous waste of money. And so therefore, dialogue becomes mandatory. And, you know, you have a problem. Oh, you want the South China Sea? Well, let's have a talk. Let's talk it out. What do you need from the South China Sea? Oh, maybe you want to invest in some oil wells there. You don't need sovereignty or to build fake islands to have to drill some well. You have a company invest in the well. Pay a little royalty to Sultan of Brunei. Maybe needs another basket of jewels. Or the Indonesians need a little more timber or whatever it is. The Vietnamese needs a little share. But you can still do plenty of business, no problem. Especially since the oil is going to run out anyway, and we're all going to have solar, and Elon Musk is going to send us a bunch of electric everything from California and Nevada. So dialogue becomes mandatory over this thing instead of battleships cruising around, and it's ridiculous, actually. It's a big waste, and we can't have... Of course, you guys are way ahead in California. You have daycare centers. You have Jerry Brown. I love that guy. He's totally
so
great.
So what else does Buddhism...
Sorry.
What else does Buddhism have to say about political issues today?
About what?
About political issues today.
Political.
Yeah, what else does Buddhism have to say?
Well, Buddhism is very flexible about political issues. But, for example, His Holiness, he says, you know, we have this idea that politicians are all a little corrupt and crooked, and they like looking for the donor, et cetera, and the contributor and the lobbyist and so forth. And we have this idea, and Dalai Lama feels that's not the case, that politics should be an altruistic effort, and the great politician will be the one who really does care about the people and the constituents, not just the contributors. And that's why he loves democracy, you know. And Buddha didn't attack the kings. He had been a king. He didn't attack them directly in his life, but he made a rule in the Buddhist community that there had to be majority decisions, and the abbot is not like a Western monastic abbot who has real obedience. Obedience is not a big virtue for Buddhist monks, but ethics is, but not obedience particularly. And the abbot can't make unilateral decisions about the community. And not only that, but they have a thing where the majority cannot finalize its decision until they've had a real dialogue with the minority, and there has been a reasonable adjustment so that the minority is not too alienated. They have a procedure like that. So, you know, it's a consensus. So a consensus is built before you finalize the decision. Because, of course, they were monastics and monks, you know, and mendicants, and they didn't have to worry about, you know, a lot of complicated infrastructure or whatever, you know. They were just getting free lunch, you know. So they could afford to do it. But anyway, it's put a seed in the middle of these monarchical societies that of somehow individual responsibility and so on, and the Indians or the Indian culture in ancient Eurasia was much more individualistic than Greece or Palestine or Egypt or Mesopotamia, much more so. Although we are educated in the West to think that we are the ragged individualists, but that's our provincialism. You know, I always tell my students, to do the individualism test in case they think that individualism was invented in Athens. I say, do the individualism test. Do the Indian individualism thing. And they say, what is that? I said, well, go down on Broadway here. This is from Columbia. Go down on Broadway and first make a really great hairdo for yourself using cow dung. And then with your cow caca hairdo, you then strip naked and paint some stripes on yourself. And then maybe a little loincloth is okay. And then take a trident and a bowl and stalk down the street and go to the restaurant and demand a free lunch, because you're a student and you need a scholarship and you don't have money for lunch, and see how far you get down the street. And there's 80 million people like that in India still, and they get that free lunch. Even still in poor India, they get it. You know, they gather at the... So they really respect that individuals might need to drop out to develop their spiritual potential. Not that all of them do. Some of them just drop out just to have a free lunch. But they still think that overall, you know, it's like Bucky Fuller used to say, everybody should have a lifelong research and development fellowship. permanent. No, none of this $1.5 trillion of student debt. That's a disgrace. When we get a good woman president, she'll do like ancient kings and emperors, and to celebrate their inauguration, they will cancel all student debt. Totally. And absolutely 100% cancel it. And then those young people will not start off with like a ball and chain wrapped around their ankles. They're like, it's ridiculous, you know. And my wife is Scandinavian, and she informs me that if you make the grade and pass the test in Scandinavia, you're free all the way through graduate school. But they don't take everyone if they can't pass the test. Of course they don't. It's silly. It'd be a waste of time. Then they are good. They make a beautiful Volvo or something, you know, or they go skiing, do ski jumps, you know, whatever. It tells me.
So what have you found most special about the Dalai Lama as a person, as you've known him?
What's really special about the Dalai Lama, actually, my wife has a better, always better than me. I was once asked by a gentleman, Indian gentleman, wealthy one, who, you know, collect gurus type a little bit, and he said, did you ever see the Dalai Lama perform a miracle? Says to me. My wife is there, we're having lunch in the wrong building. I won't even say which building. It was their apartment. And I didn't know quite what to say. You know, I've seen some remarkable things around the Dalai Lama in my many years, but you know, you're not supposed to talk about something sort of special, you know. So then, but my wife, oh, many times, she says. So I'm like, what is she going to say? And he's leaning forward in his chair like this. And she said, I've seen him, we've hosted him many times for talks and things here in New York and this and that. And we've been in many events that he's done and so forth. I've seen him in stressed out situations and in crowded situations. Everybody wants a piece of him type of thing. And I have never seen him be with anyone without giving them his full attention and focus for however short a time it may be, even in a crowd. He completely focuses on those people and gives them his total attention and concern. She says, and that's a miracle. She says. And that guy goes, oh, give me a break. He was so let down, but he was so right, you know. And I think people often, when they meet Dalai Lama, they will feel tears, they will feel sentimental, they'll feel emotional, and so on. And he'll laugh, kind of, in something. Although lately, he'll also get emotional sometimes. But they will. And I think the way I would explain it is, we usually meet people, and between us and them is a kind of a wall. I mean, it can be a friendly wall, but they have their boundary, we have our boundary. We reach out, shake hands, you know. Means we don't, you know, shaking hands means you don't have a weapon in your hand, you know, right? Very ancient time. And, you know, we'll be as nice as possible. But still, it's like we're over here and they're over there, you know. Whereas the Dalai Lama's open-heartedness that he talks about is like where you feel when you meet that that he's both here and there. So you suddenly feel like there's a second energy with you, not just yourself. And your own boundary kind of feels relaxed, can expand or something like that. And you feel kind of secure and at peace, like you met your mom or you met, you know, your beloved or something like that. And he's not looking goggle-eyed at you or Google anything. He might be joking or teasing you. And he's very humorous. Like, for example, one time, the story I'll tell, one time in 1980 it was, and I was there on a fellowship in a sabbatical year, and I just got tenure and everything on a sabbatical year, and I was there with four kids. And I at the end of a year of doing interviews with him and different things, and studying other things too myself and being with the family, and I brought the whole family for a farewell interview. And then I wanted to show the kids that we haven't been very rigid with the kids, like you have to do this and that Buddhist formality with anybody, you know. But I thought one time I should show them that you bow to your Lama and all this kind of thing. So we go in and I'm bringing them in, you know, and then I start trying to bow, you know, like full bow, like you do formally to a Lama when you're in a certain ritual setting. He doesn't do that with people, but I was trying to do it. So as I'm going down in the bow, he grabs my hand to shake it. Because he thinks he doesn't want to set the children on the daddy is doing some weird thing. And so I'm like falling over like this. And I'm practically flopping on the floor and I have to gain. And my wife is laughing and the kids are laughing. Everybody's laughing. He's laughing. And he's like, I'm like that, you know. So then, okay. And then my wife says, oh, don't bow. He doesn't want you to bow. So then, okay, fine. So we're shaking hands. And then we're starting to sit down. And then suddenly our youngest, who at that time was like 2.5, he's doing the Australian crawl across the floor. Because he thought that's what I was doing, and that what you're supposed to do is swim across the floor, you know. And then the Dalai Lama totally cracked up, and we had a lovely audience, you know, really quite nice. And the kids also saved me when the Dalai Lama was sort of annoyed with me another 10 years earlier, and I met him after, you know, and they wrote in the book, my co-authors, that where the Dalai Lama sees me coming, and he says, oh, there's my monk. Oh, wait, what's that? That's his family? Then it says to me, you've been productive, you know, but that it didn't happen quite like that, actually. But that's what they wrote, and I left it because too expensive to redraw the whole thing.
Of course.
So, and it gets the gist of the point. But what it was that he was a little nervous, and my wife was there, and I was very nervous with that first meeting. With that time, we had two kids. And then suddenly, in the middle of that, the eldest son, who at that time was like three, he leaps into the Dalai Lama's arms with his sunny smile and his golden curls and knocks the Dalai Lama's glasses way across the room. And then everybody cracks up, you know. And the Dalai Lama decides, well, it's has a beautiful child and a nice person. So then he blessed our union. He's special. He's a special person. And, you know, the main thing today about us is we tend to despair. Because we can't understand how things can go so wrong. And you here in California showed that with your millions of votes for our own homegrown Angela Merkel. You know, that we should have had, you know. You know, a woman, Dalai Lama actually once said, maybe I should reincarnate as a woman. Because in the 21st century, it's very important. Women are less quick to go to violence than men. And maybe leadership of the women is really important, so maybe I will. And he said that in Italy the first time I heard him. And he actually said, and in that case, he said, I'll be much more beautiful. And he goes like that. He makes a fashion gesture. You know. Of course, the Italians just went nuts. They loved it. But he meant it a little bit. And of course, Tibetans look kind of jumpy. You know, like. But, you know, so we tend toward feeling worried and despaired and nothing can work out and it always goes wrong. And we're kind of convinced that goodness is weaker than badness, you know. And, you know, render unto Caesar. And Caesar must be stronger than Jesus, you know. Meanwhile, Jesus didn't get killed, you know. I always try to remind Mel Gibson, nobody killed Jesus because he didn't die. He showed you can't kill love. It's more powerful. So we mustn't get discouraged and we mustn't be despaired. And the deepest motive of making the Dalai Lama better known to people, at the end it shows his vision of the restored Tibet becoming the jewel of China to show off to the world its beauty. And Chinese culture itself is beautiful. And China supported and sustained Tibet for centuries, you know, as the guardians of their headwaters and as like, you know, adepts of the Buddhism that they love in China, although it's different, a little different, the two kinds of Buddhism. But, and now they love the Dalai Lama underground in China and in Taiwan totally, but openly, but underground they do in China by the hundreds of millions. So it will all work out. This nonviolence will work and it will not leave people wanting revenge, you know. That's the great thing about solving something nonviolently with dialogue. You make a compromise, it's a win-win, people get something out of it. And we show Tibet, you know, at the end, which is the Dalai Lama's vision of the future, which he told me in 1981 at Harvard, actually, in an interview I did, the Switzerland of Asia. You know, the people from crowded Calcutta and Beijing and Shanghai, they can go up in the mountains and they can go to, a sanatorium like you have in Switzerland. They can get wonderful herbal medicine and they can get a good, nice Chinese veggies. The Chinese are a little better cooks. Tibetan cooking is a little bit, yak stew, you know, it's a little something, and zamba. And they love Chinese cooking themselves, you know. And it will be really beautiful. And we can fly over there and take a hike and, It's people who have to climb a mountain can climb, and they have a lot of hot springs. You know, they have over here the hot springs, people frolicking in the hot springs. And it'll be really great to have another really big Switzerland. And it will also be very important for all of the people from in an arc from Pakistan to North China, because all of the headwaters of all of those rivers come from Tibet. And if the Tibetan glaciers are to be melted by too much population there and too fast, too much desertification and too much tree cutting and so forth, as the Chinese have been doing, you know, for money, then it will dry up those headwaters rather badly. And then in the monsoon cycle, when there's no monsoon, those rivers will dry up. The Brahmaputra, the Ganges, the Irrawaddy, the Mekong, it'll be a disaster beyond global proportions. It really will. So it won't happen, actually. And so we shouldn't be despaired. And we have these problems. And in a way, maybe what's happened, you know, Citizens United and weirdos here and weirdos there, we're seeing now that we can't let the system go on corrupted like this. And we have to, everybody, if we had, like my wife scolds me, in Scandinavia, 90% vote in every election. And in Europe, where they had a world war on their territory, they generally voted at a much higher rate than here. And if people weren't depressed and discouraged, and they were told by left and right both that your vote doesn't matter, you have no power, you can't do anything, you're not a billionaire oligarch, nothing you can do. And so people don't bother. And then we get these kind of miscarriages, right? So be optimistic and be happy. And that's, and if you see the Dalai Lama in the midst of what he has gone through for 82 years, being cheery as can be, and cracking jokes with John Oliver, I look that up on YouTube, you know. They're cracking jokes, and like they're both like, it's so cute. It really is. Then you'll be cheered up, you know, and you won't mind when CNN goes on and on about what nonsense is going on over at the circus, where they're supposed to be serving us. And they better get back to it. Don't you think? Yes. So this will help. Okay?
Thank
you very much. So, oh, shouldn't we stop? It's you. Yeah, I'm fine.
As you said, the Dalai Lama is an exceptional person, and you're an exceptional person for documenting his life and interpreting him to the rest of the world. Thank you. Our thanks to Robert Thurman, professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University, co-author of the new book, Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. Thank you to the audience here on the radio, television, and the internet, to the Osher Foundation for supporting this series. Dr. Thurman's book is for sale in the lobby. He'll be pleased to sign books in the fireside room following the program. One last thing. As the club is about to depart our temporary headquarters, our landlord, the owner of this building, Martin Brown, is here. Thank you for giving us a place to be during the past 2 years. Thank you.
Oh, that's great. Bravo. That's wonderful.
And now this program of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you, Gloria. All right.